The third case for oral argument this morning is Charles W. Brown, appellant versus the Northern Hills Regional Railroad Authority, et al. For the appellant is Mr. Kenneth Duell, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellees, Mr. Thomas E. Brady, an attorney from Spearfish. Mr. Duell, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Madam Clerk, may it please the court, we're here today on an appeal from the decision of Judge Warren Johnson, the trial judge, in a quiet title action that my client and I started to resolve an issue of the abandonment of the CMW Railroad right-of-way on my client's property between Whitewood and Deadwood, South Dakota. It is our belief that the trial court erred when it held that the United States had a reversionary right in that right-of-way such that was preserved so that the Railroad Abandonment Act of 43 U.S.C. 912 came into play, that act then directed that the railroad right-of-way had to be abandoned in a certain statutory process. It's our belief that that's a misapplication of federal law, and it's a misinterpretation of federal case authority, specifically on point. I have provided to you a very simplistic layout of the timing of the events that occurred in this case. Of course, before in 1862 was the Homestead Act, but the first important act that applies to us today is the Railroad Right-of-Way Act of 1875. Under that, the Fremont, Elkhorn, and Missouri Valley Railroad in 1890 completed the platting and platted the Whitewood to Deadwood Railroad right-of-way, a road section that's about 11.5 miles in length. Then, in 1918 and 1919, the United States issued patents to my client's predecessors in interest, and in that patent made specific reservations only of water for mining purposes and right-of-ways for ditches and canals.
Finish what you were saying.
But it did not make a reservation of the railroad right-of-way.
But you don't dispute, and I thought you mentioned this in your brief as well, that the patent, they took the patent to the land subject to that earlier right-of-way given by the U.S. Congress.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So that even though it doesn't say it on that patent, and if you just read the patent, you wouldn't see it, it still was subject to that right-of-way because it was a congressional act.
That's correct.
Okay. So if we just go no further than 1918, wouldn't that patent and the title of that property still be subject to the right-of-way of the railroad?
It was still subject to the right-of-way, which had been granted to the railroad company, railroad right-of-way. But what the case law is important, Justice Meyer Henry, is in 1942, the Great Northern Railroad Company case said that easements under the 1875 Act were only a surface easement. Not to be confused with the 1871 Act transfers, which were some bizarre thing called a reverter fee or a reversionary interest type act. The 1875 Act was a surface easement only.
Okay, so it still is. So even so, that service right-of-way is still attached to that land.
Absolutely. Okay. The appellee says we said that we claimed that it was not. That's simply wrong. The easement, the surface easement, was in place. My client predecessors took the patent subject to that. But what is critical is that under the Great Western Railroad case and all the cases thereafter, the United States, by giving up a patent, gave up all right, title, and interest in the property, unless they make a specific reservation in that patent. They did not.
The problem is that, like the Great Northern case, actually was deciding mineral rights.
Absolutely.
Not surface rights or right-of-way rights. And it looks to me like the Supreme Court's been a little bit schizophrenic in deciding what the nature of this interest is here. And aren't we ultimately going to have to decide or guess what the Supreme Court is ultimately going to say about the nature of this interest? Because, I mean, the cases are divided, and it simply depends on whether you look at these individual cases since 1942 that have described it non-common law, or as the common law principles would apply, versus some of the other cases that say, no, this is a special federal interest. I mean, that's ultimately, at the end of the day, what this all comes down to, isn't it?
With all due respect, please don't guess, because I think it's clear from the United States Supreme Court's decisions that 1875 Act easements are different than 1871 Acts and the earlier Acts, which were the Acts that said, we're giving the railroad the land, we're giving them the fee. 1875 said, we're giving you a surface easement only. The Great Northern case and all the cases thereafter all said it's a surface permission. It is an easement. It is nothing more.
But there is no revert or fee in it.
But
the Supreme Court's gone back and forth. I mean, until Great Northern, it was the special federal something with the reverter and this and that. So, I mean, they've indicated, it looks to me like they changed their opinion on what it is depending on the facts of the case.
I don't think they did with respect to 1875 Act easements. They did with 1871 in the earlier Railroad Acts. 1875, they said, this is a surface easement, and just like the mineral interests in the Great Northern Railroad case, that left when you gave up the patent. And like the cases thereafter in the federal courts and in the United States Supreme Court, they've consistently held that when you give a patent, it is the highest title you can hold. It is conclusive evidence against the United States that it no longer holds anything that's not specifically reserved in the patent.
But why would they have to put railroad in there? Because at the time the patent was issued, the railroad was there. It was obvious for everybody to see. I can see why they say, you know, for canals and things like that, there are no canals out there, but there's the railroad, and I assume in 1918 they assumed it was going to be there forever, just like we assume an interstate highway is going to be there forever.
The water rights were by federal statute. The canals were by federal statute. They specifically referenced them because they intended to reserve it. It was clear that there was never an intent to keep a reverter interest or a preserved interest in the United States under the 1875 Act. There's nothing in that act. If you read the federal cases, they say, Barris and Hash more recently, Persault in 96, they all say when you read the act, there's no preservation of a reserved interest.
Well, let's assume that we agree with you on that. So then the service right-of-way is owned by the railroad has that.
Yes.
Not owned, I suppose, but they have a right to it, held by the railroad. And what happens then? Let's assume that service, and they own that, or they have and hold that right away. Now lead me through that. Oh. So then the federal government, I agree with you, the federal government doesn't have anything to do with it. They don't have a reverter. But doesn't the railroad still retain that right away? And now that's who still retains the right away, is a railroad.
With all due respect, they do not.
Okay, now because tell me why not.
After the patent was issued, the railroad, which held the surface easement to my client's fee interest, went on. But in 1968, they made a determination to abandon that easement. And if you look at the federal...
But they didn't they sell it?
Well, they didn't have a right to sell it.
Well, is that a legal question?
That's a legal question. It was to be used for the railroad, to be used by the railroad for a railroad.
But it is being used as a railroad.
With all due respect, it is not. Let me finish my argument as to what happened. In 1968, they started that abandonment. They made an application for abandonment and then completed that process through 1970. And in December 31, 1970, reported to the ICC that we are done with this line. It's not an abandonment of service. It's we tore up our ties. We tore up our tracks. We sold our other fee title properties. We are no longer in the railroad business in that area. That is a federal common law abandonment under Leo Sheep and Persault. They say you have to look at the law which was in effect at the time the patents were issued. And that law was a federal common law of abandonment, an intent to abandon, number one, and number two, specific acts intending to relinquish that right or privilege. Clearly, the railroad did that by the acts in 1968 through December of 1970. It said, it gave notices to the world, it sent notice to the governor, we are done with this railroad. We are closing it down. It's not economical. We're tearing up our tracks. They clearly abandoned their privilege, their surface easement to the property. So what they did in 1972 is a proverbial Brooklyn Bridge. They sold the state whatever they had, if anything, and they had nothing. And I believe that's the way the simple law applies.
But the abandonment issue wasn't really tried at the trial court level, right?
The trial court said...
Did not make any findings specifically along the line of whether or not they'd abandoned it.
No, what the trial court did is our affidavits, our submissions, said that the railroad had been abandoned and the easement had been dissolved. The appellees said we abandoned only service and thereafter we sold it to the state. And the court said I don't have to do that because I think under the mistaken belief that there's a Federal Reserve right that under that federal statute 912 they could give it to someone else or sell it to the state.
If we decided that 912 doesn't apply.
Does not apply.
We have to remand it for the trial court to take evidence and make a decision on whether it's abandoned otherwise.
You could, yes. But I think
either it, disputes or is it
the appellee's going to get up here and say that there was an abandonment only of service. We never intended to give up the easement.
So is that a matter of law or is that a matter of findings of fact?
I think it's a question of law because it's clear that they gave the abandonment notices. They went through the process of abandonment. They removed the ties. They removed the tracks. They removed the signage. They did everything to say this is not a railroad. And then they told the ICC, we are not going to pay tariffs. We're not going to pay centrally assessed taxes in South Dakota. We're done with this property. And they walked away. Under federal common law, in effect at the appropriate time, that's abandonment.
But they would never have paid taxes on there right away anyway, would they?
They have centrally assessed duties to the state of South Dakota.
Right, but that's not on right-of-ways, is it? I mean, the person who owns the land over which the right-of-way is running always pays the taxes, don't they?
That's a tax in lieu of.
That's a tax in lieu of that. They pay on the rails, the improvements, and everything else on the land. They quit because they tore it up. They removed all of that. All of their improvements are gone, except for this tunnel that's on my client's land that's about 1,200, 1,500 feet long, and we own about 1,000 feet of that, and a couple of bridges, that they did not remove. But everything else was removed.
And that was the December 31st, 1970 date?
Yes, that's what they reported to the IRS or to the ICC, that was all completed before that. And then, in April of 1972, the ICC, looking back, said, we acknowledge your abandonment as of 12/31/1970. And so it's our position that when that act occurred under the applicable federal scheme, the railroad had given up its right, its privilege, its surface easement under the 1875 Act. And that's what Persault says. That's the implication and intent of Barris and Hash, the Federal Court of Claims and the federal...
Those are all condemnation issues dealing with, aren't they?
Yes, but look at the underlying premise of the case. The premise is that, yes, you can convert those to rails for trails because it's an appropriate federal policy to do that, but it's a second taking because the abandonment occurred.
Well, how could it be a taking if they know, under your theory, they wouldn't have anything to take?
If, in fact, this court's going to say there's a right-of-way there that can be transferred to the state, to Game Fish and Parks, to this Northern Hills Railroad Authority, that's a second taking, and that's clearly the intent, the opinions.
If under your theory, they would have abandoned it in 1970, so applying those cases, those federal cases, they wouldn't apply at all because under your theory, they wouldn't have anything, they wouldn't be a taking of anybody's property, would they?
Correct. If you say there's no right-of-way, mm-hmm. if there's no privilege, no purpose, no right to be on our property, they don't apply for the conclusion. But the underlying premise is correct. That is that 912 doesn't apply so that you can get rails to trails and thus condemnation. 912 doesn't apply because the patents gave up every interest the United States had in the land prior to the enactment of 43912 in 1922. It's exactly the same factual scenario. Nothing more, nothing different. It is the same case, and you have to reach the same conclusion, and that's how they get to the decision. Well, then if you're going to impose a rails to trails, for example, on that property in that scenario, that's a second taking.
Let's assume the abandonment issue is not controlled by the federal ICC abandonment and that it is a South Dakota common law abandonment. Then what?
Same result, because South Dakota has a very simple course for determining abandonment. You said it 2 years ago in Graves versus Dennis. You have to look at the facts.
Would we have to send it back for that?
I suppose you would, because the judge really never resolved that issue.
How much of the Persaud case is still usable after Brennan decided the Supreme Court case basically on a different ground? I mean, he never really got to much of the analysis that you rely on.
The 1996 Persaud case, I think it's still good law. I think the basic premise of it is that it looked at Leo Sheep, it looked at Great Northern in 1942, and then Leo Sheep in 56 or whatever, and said the patents gave up the land, and you have to look to what was in place when the patents were released. And when that happened, the government gave up all right, title, and interest, and the right to control by congressional legislation or regulation.
How about Barney? I know you've been careful not to say it was wrongly decided or anything, or ask for reversal, but it seems to me that if we adopt your view of this case, we do have to essentially overrule Barney.
I don't think you do. With all due respect, I think Barney was wrong because we stood up here and argued Barney. But with all due respect, 912, and the issue was never considered by this court, does 912 even apply? And the court never evaluated that because it never looked at the issue, what was the timing of the patents? What was reserved by the United States in the patents that were issued? That was never addressed in Barney. It's very clear in this case.
But Barney clearly adopted the special federal description of property rights.
A reverter interest. Yeah. But as the cases say, Great Northern, Persaud, all of those in 86 say, that's a surface easement.
But those cases were in existence when Barney was decided.
Not Persaud 96.
No, but
Persaud 1 was.
Great Northern was.
Great Northern was, and it said it was a surface easement. But what was never addressed in Barney was the underlying question of, wait a minute, is this post-patent legislation? Did we not look at that issue? And I think it's clear when you read Barney that was never considered. The court assumed that 912 was in place and the patents were issued and off you go. And so Barney doesn't apply. You don't have to do anything to Barney. It's separate. It's not the law that applies to a simplistic series of events where the United States divested itself of all interest prior to the enactment of 912 in 1922. It'd be like going back and saying, we gave you your patent, Mr. Dole, but now in 1995 we decided we want the minerals, and so we're going to issue a rule as to how those minerals are going to be removed from your property by others. You can't do that. The patent is the conclusive evidence of title against the United States. It's a title to which my predecessors were entitled to rely. It's a title to which Mr. Brown is entitled to rely. And any subsequent federal legislation, any post-patent legislation that attempts to affect that common federal common law abandonment process is ineffective. And for those reasons, we think the trial court was in error because it said there it was transferred. If you read it, it's really confusing because it talks about before the federal reversionary interest could apply. That implies that there was one. There was not. And for those reasons, we believe that the trial court erred, and this case must be reversed and perhaps remanded.
One last time.
Yes.
There was a federal reversionary interest until 1945.
No.
A limited fee. They called it a limited fee.
No, I, with all due respect, I do not think so. I think that if you look specifically at the cases, they're talking about the 1871 Act, and that was a confusing mess. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duell. Mr. Brady, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. It pleased the court, counsel. I think the questions posed earlier were on point. The Brown appeal is nothing less than a frontal attack on Barney v. State of South Dakota, or if not, at least an attack from both flanks. And I think it's very clear what the law is, and it is not as complex as it's attempted to be made, but maybe it needs to be made that complex to attempt to obtain a reversal. This court in Barney v. South Dakota, authored by then Circuit Court and now Justice Meyer Henry, is on point and does properly address the circumstances. We must be mindful of the history of the railroads in the United States, and specifically the 1875 Railroad Act. This is 1875 Railroad Act property, the same as it was in Barney. That was 1875 Railroad Act property. As Justice Zinner noted, there has been some transition from since the 1875 Act, of the interpretation of just what type of property interest a right-of-way was created by that act, whether it was fee, limited fee, easement. The transition of that to today is that it's an exclusive easement for the use of that property as right-of-way. But that does not change the results in Barney, does not change the results of the Circuit Court or the conclusions made. What is important is that the 1875 Act and other acts relative to railroads, the intent of Congress was to create these transportation corridors. And through that process, these corridors were created, and then and thereafter, Congress through the Interstate Commerce Clause, has the right to control and regulate its interests as to whatever it may have. Now, the cases relied on by Brown, that being Barris and Hash, are very limited and restricted cases in that and really are of no consequence to the decision to be made here. The Barris decision was a summary judgment ruling on the reversionary interest of the United States in 1875 Act property.
Now, if we'd have had those two cases when Barney was written, we may have gone the other way on Barney.
I think you would not have, because I think you reached the right conclusion, but there is a minute and insignificant difference in that you're dealing with fee versus easement. And in your Barney decision, you properly point out all the principles and concepts in that Congress, when it enacted the 1875 Railroad Act and when it enacted Section 912, 913, 23 U.S.C. 316, rather than dealing with reversionary fee interest in the United States government, what Congress actually was doing is dealing with their interstate commerce rights and privileges of regulation and control of these right-of-ways, these transportation corridors, which they created, and thereafter have the right to maintain and dictate and direct how they may be abandoned, and what would happen under certain events. So Section 912, 913, and 23 U.S.C. 316 applies to 1875 Act right-of-way, as was concluded in Barney, as was concluded in Villa, in and in fact, actually, Section 912 is applicable and is concluded in Barris and Hash and things of that nature. So, no, it was not erroneous. I think to the extent if Barney suggested that the United States had a reversionary fee interest, if Hash and Barris are correct, then that would be incorrect. But that said, and as was noted in the opinion, in that the easement granted by Congress, referring to the 1875 Act easement, is an easement subject to the intentions and specifications of Congress, and it is not a common law easement. That is a proper statement of the law, not inconsistent with anything cited by appellant.
Mr. Brady, though, here's the problem with Barney. Barney clearly is premised on an assumption that this is a federal law question and that this was a limited fee made on implied condition of reverter. That's the beginning of the opinion, and it relies on Townsend, which was reversed, essentially, by Great Northern. So it seems to me that that there is an argument about whether Barney still is valid, because it clearly says that the nature of this interest is controlled by federal legislation, and the right-of-way interest conveyed is a limited fee made on an implied condition of reverter. That principle is gone. That, after Great Northern, that's no longer good law, that statement.
Great Northern was decided in 1942, and that language does appear in Barney. That is not, though, the essence of Barney or upon which Barney is properly decided. You look at pages 729 through 731 in the analysis by this court in Barney, and you look at that, and these cases have all dictated that sections 912, 913, and USC 23 USC 316 are acts of Congress wherein they are setting forth their intentions and specifications relative to these easements. And that it's under the broad powers of the interstate commerce, and they have the authority to grant railroads easements subject to its own terms and conditions, as I quote from Barney. And it goes on to state that the reversionary interest may be incorrect if it's referring to the reversionary interest into the United States. But that's a different issue. The United States is not a party here. What we're talking about is if there's an abandonment of an easement, and only if it's abandoned would it revert to the patent holders and their successors in interest. That is a question of federal law and the application of sections 912, 913, and 23 U.S.C. 316. As Barney did properly conclude, because those enactments, when made in 1920, 21, and 1958, all were done by Congress in the context of the 1875 Railroad Act easements having been granted and the transition of those past Great Northern and Leo, etc. You look at the congressional language, as was discussed in the Barney case and cited, and it was, I believe, one of the representatives of South Dakota raised the question, and that is quoted in Barney. You also go back and look at the discussions of the 1875 Act in Congress, and underlying the whole principle of that is Congress was going to maintain control of these right-of-ways as to maintain the transportation corridors or to facilitate the transfer and conveyance of those corridors. That's what they did by Section 912 and 23 U.S.C. 316. And so very clearly, to the extent that Hash or Barris may take exception to whether the United States government has a reversionary interest, that is not determinative of this case.
Except in this case, which is different from Barney, is that the whole issue in Barney is whether it was a condemnation to take those corridors and turn them into trails. Here, that's not an issue.
That's true. It's not
because the right-of-way is still, for the same purpose, is still being used, is my understanding, for railroad.
It's intended to be used for railroad.
Right.
It's not actively being used.
I understand. But, I mean, the nature of the corridor in this case isn't changing. And a lot of the analysis in Barney dealt with that. So I guess my question to you is the same, is that let's assume 912 doesn't apply. Then what do we do?
Well, if you would have that assumption, then what you're suggesting is that it would be state law controlled abandonment and would be a question that would have to go back. I submit that this court has concluded that 912 does apply to 1875 Railroad Act property, as had a host of other cases, and Barris and Hash does not say it does not. There is no case that says 912 does not apply. What those cases say is that it may, in the application of this to a rails-to-trails proposition, that may be a taking by the federal government. Federal government's not a party to this. That's not an issue of this litigation. The point is the federal government set those up.
It would be under certain circumstances. I mean, if we rule, it could be an issue, isn't that right, depending on how we rule? Whether or not it's another taking?
That's a federal question and a federal government issue and problem if, in fact, that be true.
Is it?
It's not because a state, it's not us.
The state, didn't the right-of-way go to the state of South Dakota?
That is correct. And quite simply, that was done. And please, if you look at the appendixes, where in there is set forth the sections 912 and 316. 912 has two prongs to it. Barney followed the first prong in the sense that there was the ICC abandonment. And it's undisputed that the ICC, Congress, did not give them the authority to conclude a right-of-way was abandoned, but merely to address whether service could be discontinued. And that is what happened in Barney. And that is precisely what happened in this case. Also what happened in this case in the resolution of the Chicago Northwestern, you need to look at the entirety of it and not the limited quoted portion as contained in appellant's brief, because the entirety of that resolution was to abandon the right-of-way, meaning the service with the ICC, and thereafter to convey the right-of-way. And that is precisely what they did, and a conveyance as a matter of law is totally inconsistent act with an intent to abandon. But this court, the trial court, did not get there because 912 and 316 apply.
But to follow up on Justice Myriader's question, if 912 doesn't apply under state common law concerning abandonment of easements, it's the acts of the railroad at 1970, not just what the ICC order may say, that would control whether someone abandons an easement. And certainly taking up the track and all that type of thing tends to show, does it not, that they were abandoning their their easement.
That would be the argument trying to set forth a series of facts that abandonment occurred under state law. But what would be conclusive of that is a quitclaim deed conveying that interest is an absolute act inconsistent with abandonment.
But you don't have to have a quitclaim deed to abandon an easement. Your conduct alone can do that, aside from a deed.
No, but the you have to look at the entirety of the resolution and then the agreement entered into with the state of South Dakota, and then the conduct to abandon service, because if they abandon service without ICC approval, ICC, federal government, can come back in and enjoin them from that act and compel them to run trains. So that is the first step of what is necessary. And if 912 does not apply, then you would look at the whole series of acts and the conveyance by the Chicago Northwestern to the state of South Dakota is an act totally inconsistent with state common law abandonment. And thus, as a matter of law, it would not be abandonment anyway, even under state law. You follow 912, there's two concepts. First is the ICC abandonment, which allows it to go into the process. Then it requires a court of competent jurisdiction or a congressional act to do the abandonment. In this case, there's been no judicial declaration by a court of competent jurisdiction, nor congressional act. Also, though,
as an aside, what did Congress mean by this court of competent jurisdiction? In this case, what court has jurisdiction to declare the abandonment? If everything's done right, we started over in a new case. What's the proper court with jurisdiction to declare an abandonment? Is it a state court, a federal court, or what?
I cannot point you to any precise language of any case identifying what a court of competent jurisdiction is. I would believe it would be a federal district court or a court of claims. It would be a federal court because these are transportation corridors created by congressional acts. And I don't know that Congress would defer to a state circuit court to make that declaration. That is my best belief on that. Mind you, I've looked.
Side issue.
Yes, it is.
Does a quitclaim deed itself raise a red flag as to what was transferred? They certainly gave no warranty deed, right?
That's correct.
And so does a quitclaim deed itself raise a question, a red flag, as to I'm conveying whatever interest I have. I don't know if I have any, but I'm conveying whatever I have. Is that right?
Well, certainly. To the extent that it's not a warranty for which you would have liability if, in fact, you conveyed something you did not have. But it still conveys effectively as a warranty deed that which you do have. And it is the right-of-way, which is allowed to be conveyed under 23 U.S.C. 316. And that's on page 13 of the appendix, where Congress authorized railroads to convey their right-of-ways to states. And that's precisely what the Chicago Northwestern did in 1972 after they completed obtaining the approval of the ICC to abandon service. They had the agreement with the state and thereafter conveyed to the state of South Dakota for $5,000 consideration this right-of-way. Now,
is there an explanation in the record why the Burlington Northern didn't follow through with 912, with the declaration or act of Congress? I didn't see anything explaining that.
Well, first of all, a railroad is not compelled to seek a declaration of a court of competent jurisdiction or an act of Congress to complete the abandonment. What they did is they abandoned service. That means they don't have to run trains. That means that they hold that right-of-way, and at a later date, if the economy changes, the circumstances change, they can go and reestablish train service by application of the ICC on this route. And so it's there. Alternatively, if that decree is made by a court of competent jurisdiction or an act of Congress, Then they have 1 year thereafter to convey to a governmental entity to establish a road. But in this circumstance, what happened, there's no decree and no act of Congress. So in this circumstance, and you look at the second part of 912 on page 12 of the index, and in that circumstance, it states, provided that this section shall not affect conveyances made by any railroad company of portions of its right-of-way, if such conveyance be among those which have been or may after March 8, 1922 and before such abandonment be validated and confirmed by any act of Congress. So what it says is, if there has not been an act of Congress, the railroad can convey.
Your time has expired, Council. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Newell, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Sit over there.
We've had problems with the heating system. The last couple of
it's nice and cool over there.
That's to keep us awake.
Keep us awake and keep us moving. May it please the court. Let's focus on Barney for just a minute. Barney presumed that 912 applied. It's clear that I believe that if Barney had seen that, in fact, that 912 was a post-patent legislative act, that Barney may have perhaps been different. But that's why you can set Barney aside and say 912, as it relates to the specific act or specific action in Charles Brown's case, that Barney does not apply because 912 is clearly a post-patent legislative act. It occurred after the United States had totally divested itself of all right, title, or interest in the property in the patents. It preserved nothing relating to the railroad. Those cases are replete, starting with Great Northern in 42 and thereafter. Every case that talks about 1875, specifically in that vein, looks at that and says 912 is a post-patent legislative act that cannot reach back and change that patent. Once it's gone from government control, it's always gone. And that is the purpose. That is the basis of cases like Persault and Barons and Hash. Those Rails to Trails cases got to condemnation because the court said 912 didn't preserve the right in the federal government to create a Rails to Trails and transfer that ownership to a Rails to Trails facility while the property is being held in abeyance under the right-of-way because it's not being used. What those cases said is it's a second taking because it's a good act. It's a good federal policy. But in doing that, it's a second taking because 912 had nothing to preserve. There was no way for 912 to stick to the land and then for the Rails to Trails Act in 83 and 88 to come in on top of that. So all of those cases, Persault and Barris and Hash and Toes, I believe it is, in 2000, all say once it's gone, it's gone. And that's what's before us today. And 912 does not apply. And when you then look, you need to first look at federal common law. I believe under Leo Sheep and those other cases cited in our brief, you have to look at the federal structure when the patents were released, 1918, 1919. Those cases say, even view the one cited primarily by the appellant to think that 912 sticks. But if you look at the federal common law, it says you need two things, an intent to abandon and physical acts indicating a clear intent to relinquish the easement. And it's very clear that the resolution of the Board of Directors of the Chicago Northwestern Railroad in 1969 says this is an expensive piece of property. We can't get up the hill. It's not marketable. The freight's not good. We want to abandon this line of service, this line of railroad in all respects. and then directed the board of directors to complete that process, doing whatever else is necessary.
What did they do then when they decided to sell it? Did they have another resolution?
They refer back to their 1968 resolution, and how they get to there, I have no clue, because it does not, with all due respect to Mr. Brady, say that it includes the right to sell our surface easements. The resolution of 1968 says we have a right to sell our real estate holdings, and they did have other real estate holdings that they notified the ICC that they had their turn stations, their round tables, you know, those types of properties that they held fee to. And that's what they had a right to sell. And that's what they did sell in some respect to the state of South Dakota in May of 2002.
So they did sell some fee?
Yes.
All right, fee land as well?
Yes. But then, under the quitclaim deed, they also said, we're going to give you, we hereby quitclaim any interest we have, if any, in this property, which includes my client's property in Section 1.
And that was in the 1972?
Yes, in that deed, yes. I think it's Exhibit K in the admitted exhibits. They said, if we have it, it's yours. But we're making no warranties. We're not saying we do. And I submit under federal law, federal common law, the Act of 1875, they had nothing to give.
But Mr. Dole, one last time. How do we get around the conclusion in Barney that says we conclude that the United States government retained a reversionary interest in railroad rights-of-way, including those granted post-1871?
1871.
Post-1871.
I understand.
I.e., 1875.
I know. That's that confusion, because the presumption was in Barney that 912 had something to stick to. There is not a reversionary interest held in the name of the United States to which 912 could apply.
So you're saying Barney's wrong?
I'm saying Barney did not consider that issue. I'm saying that if Barney were considered in this courtroom today, looking at subsequent federal action that clearly say the 1875 Act is a surface easement, there's no reversionary interest, no reverted interest, no limited fee, it's a surface easement, and the patent gave everything else to the patentee, Barney might be considered differently, might be determined differently. But I think Barney can be set aside because I don't believe the court even considered the issue because it presumed 912 applied. And I submit to you that in 2006, it's very clear under the status of the federal law, which we all apply every day, and this court looks at and rules upon and includes in its opinions, under federal law, 912 does not apply to this particular piece of patented property. And when it does not apply, then federal common law shows that the railroad abandoned this property, abandoned its easement, in addition to releasing service. You know, to get rid of service, all you have to do is say, I'm not running a train. I'm not going to sell tickets. I'm not going to take freight. But they didn't do that. They told the world, we are abandoning this in all respects in their resolution in 1968. And they gave notice. If you look at the notices and the notice to the governor and the final act, they sold everything off. They tore up the ties, the rails and the ties, removed the signs. They got rid of their liability on this property. I submit to you that if you looked at this on a injury case in 1971, the railroad's answer would have been, we don't have an interest there because we abandoned it by all of our actions in December 31, 1970. And so they did everything that the federal common law required for an abandonment to occur under the scheme that was applicable to this property, to this patented property. And under that, there's nothing to give away. If 912 does apply, which I respectfully submit does not, then you would go to the question I think Justice Gilbertson had, or whose responsibility is it? Is it my client's responsibility to go to federal court or to state court? And I think Phillips, a 1976 case, talking about an ICC determination first before you come to court, I think that case actually says it's state or federal can be competent, court of competent jurisdiction. But whose responsibility is it? I submit that it would be the railroads. They're the ones who made the money. They're the ones who had the privilege. They're the ones who were trying to be relieved of their ICC duties, their freight hauling public responsibilities. They're the one that wanted to be divested of this interest. And they can't just walk away and now, after the fact, 35 years later, say, by the way, you, Mr. Landlord, didn't comply with 912 because a court of competent jurisdiction never addressed it.
You actually asked the trial court, didn't you, to enter an order on that?
And I do, and I believe in my last 30 seconds, if, in fact, 912 is going to apply, I think 912 permits a court, any court, including a competent court in state court, to look back and say abandonment occurred on December 31, 1970. And that is a valid interpretation and application of 912, because that's the evidence. It may have to be remanded to do that, but I submit that this court, Graves does that. You look at the easement, the two roads, you said that road was abandoned in 1978, and your opinion was 2004.
Thank you, Mr. Biddle.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.